Okay, thank you everybody for coming, especially those of you who just came back from Berlin yesterday. I am in the morning. So I just want to introduce the scholars we have today and a little bit about the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. The Brookings Africa Growth Initiative is a program within Brookings with a mission to produce more research about Africa from African sources and to raise the African voice in policy discussions in Washington on issues related to the continent. Our initiative actually has partnered with six think tanks in Africa and we closely collaborate with researchers in Africa. So if you need a resource or on-the-ground insight, we're always available. We can connect you guys. The scholars we have today are Mwangi Kimenyi, who is a senior fellow and director of the Afro Growth Initiative here at Brookings. His research focuses on Africa's development, economic growth, political economy, and the private sector. Mwangi is a Kenyan, and he's the founding executive director of the Kenya Institute for Public Policy Research and Analysis. We also have, to my left, Whitney Schneidman, who's a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative and a senior international advisor at Covington and Burling. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and his research focuses on U.S.-African relations, trade, investment issues, and issues related to economic growth and prosperity in Africa. And then we have Haroon Bharat, all the way to my left. Haroon is Professor of Economics at the University of Cape Town, and he's Director of the Development Policy Research Unit at the University of Cape Town, which is one of our think tank partners with the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. His research interests cover labor issues, poverty, income distribution in South Africa. He has served as economic advisor to a number of South African presidents as well. So maybe we can go around the room and introduce ourselves. With my colleague over here to the right.
My name is Andrew Westbury. I'm the Assistant Director of the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings.
I'm David Lynch, Bloomberg News.
I'm Bryce Campbell. I'm the incoming Assistant Director of the AGI program.
I'm Ari Shapiro, cover the White House for NPR.
I'm Mark Felsenthal, I cover the White House for Reuters.
I'm Dave Nakamura, I cover the White House for the Washington Post.
George Condon, cover the White House for National Journal.
I'm Wes Barrett, and I cover the White House for Fox News.
Okay, and those on the call, if you could introduce yourselves.
Oh, hi, it's Kathleen Hennessy, I cover the White House for the LA Times.
Anyone else?
Alethea Jennings.
I'm Ashton Lang on the... Ashton Lang, I'm the Southern Africa correspondent for the Daily Telegraph.
Hi, and it's Nedra Pickler from the AP.
Okay, great, thank you. So, Mwangi, do you want to go ahead and start?
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for joining this press briefing on President Obama's trip to Africa next week. As you know, Africans were very excited when President Obama was elected, and they expected deeper engagement than in the past, both in regard to policy and also in terms of actual visits to the continent, given the president's African heritage. On the policy side, Africans have been largely disappointed, especially when they look at the focus on Africa by the previous presidents, in particular President Clinton and President George W. Bush, who did quite a bit. They had a lot of programs specific on Africa. This has been particularly disturbing in light of the major focus on Africa that this other president has shown. Other countries have shown, particularly China, Brazil, Turkey, and many other countries. There is therefore a feeling that President Obama is still not in tune with the emerging continent. On the visit, President Obama, of course, visited Ghana and spent about 20 hours on the continent. This time, he will be visiting Senegal, Tanzania, and South Africa. That will be increasing the number of countries to four over the last 5 years that the president will have visited. We are talking about more on the sub-Saharan Africa. But you look at the involvement of Chinese leadership over the last 5 years. Chinese leaders, they are thinking about the vice president and the president, they have visited over 30 countries, African countries, 30 countries. The vice president, even before he became president, visited. One time he visited over 10 months He visited 17 African countries. So although this visit is important, it's still seen as relatively small, something compared to what other countries are doing in terms of engaging Africa. Now, so in that sense, there is a bit of disappointment from the African side. In terms of substance, clearly, we are not quite sure that we expect major initiatives. If you look at what has happened over the last 5 years, or four plus years, there has not been real major initiatives that one can say are quite strategic or they are quite new, so to say. Most of the Africa-U.S. relationship today is defined by the Clinton and Bush program. So at this time, we don't expect major initiatives. There may be a few new programs, but they are probably not going to be large in scale. They may be isolated in particular countries, maybe some energy program in Tanzania or some security concerns programs, but we are not expecting to see major continental-wide type of approach to programs like WAR in the case of President Clinton and President Bush. So we don't expect this trip then to quell the criticisms of a president who has largely not taken Africa seriously. Nevertheless, I would say that there is excitement in the continent, particularly in those countries that he's visiting. He's still someone that Africans see as theirs, and so there will be quite a bit of excitement in Senegal, Tanzania, and also in South Africa. We expect that there will be still the same focus on governance issues, the rule of law, but again, we still some emphasis on security, particularly as it affects the United States of America. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Just one more question on the phone. Can the speakers identify themselves so we know who's talking? Thank you.
Sure, we'll definitely do that. That was Mwangi Kimenyi.
Good morning. This is Whitney Schneidman. And just to get that on the record. thanks for this. Let me take a little bit of a different approach from my friend and colleague, Mwangi Kimenyi. I think this trip has the potential for laying the groundwork for a pivot toward Africa, like we have not seen before in the U.S. Whether that pivot is realized remains to be seen over the next several years, but I think a number of things are in place that augur for a more dynamic U.S. policy. I think the process really started last year when the administration put forward a presidential policy directive. And it outlined four areas, trade and commerce, trade and investment, security, development, and democracy, that were going to be priorities for the U.S. These aren't earth-shaking objectives, but it had the impact of mobilizing the different agencies of the U.S. government to start developing initiatives. And I think this trip is a direct outgrowth of that effort. And I think we are going to see some things in this trip that will really be quite important to future U.S. engagement. There's no question that trade and investment is going to be a major focal point. The president will be doing business dialogue in Pretoria. There'll be a CEO summit in Tanzania. And that will help to catalyze not only U.S. trade and investment, but I think partnership with African businesses as well. This administration is focusing on East Africa as a major priority. And they're working on a trade and investment treaty. And that's an important initiative because it's a recognition that Africa's made up not only of 54 countries but also regions, and to sort of help U.S. companies approach the region of East Africa is an important initiative. There will be a power initiative. I think there's little dispute that the lack of electricity, the lack of power, is a constraint to growth. And the administration is going to try to move in and be a partner to addressing that concern. One of the administration's flagship initiatives is Feed the Future, an agricultural initiative, and there the goal is to lift 50 million people out of poverty over a decade. And, you know, that takes time. It's not like PEPFAR, where, you know, you put people on a medicine to save their lives. Very, extremely important. This is more of a structural change, and I think that's going to take time. In that presidential policy directive, one of the initiatives was a doing business in Africa initiative, and I think here's another area where the administration is going to try to give a definition to U.S. Engagement. And finally, the area of engaging Africa's youth or next generation of leaders. And the president will be doing a major initiative in South Africa on that as well. And it's really an effort to sort of engage the future generation of the continent. You know, the median age on the continent is about 17 years old. And to really have a dialogue, a broad dialogue with that generation on the continent is quite a priority for this administration, and I think well placed. So it remains to be seen, you know, exactly how the trip goes down, but I think I'm very encouraged by it, and like I say, I think it has the potential for opening a new chapter in U.S. engagement in Africa.
Thanks. This is Harun Borat. I'll just make five broad points about the President's visit to South Africa in particular, and then maybe conclude with some reflections on sort of broader African issues. I mean, in the context of South Africa, just very briefly, the U.S. has, if you like, a comfortable, not quite cozy, but a comfortable relationship with South Africa, built sort of from Senator Kennedy's visits during apartheid years, supporting the ANC through to the sort of more recent President Clinton, President Mandela sort of interaction that's very warm and engaging. And I think that's sort of seen the post-94, post-apartheid years cemented in terms of the U.S. and South Africa. You know, just some of the statistics, South Africa's trade with the U.S., or that trade relationship is about $22 billion U.S. dollars in 2011. The U.S. runs a slight deficit with South Africa, but it's for the U.S. It's the U.S. is 36th most important trading partner. In a sense, you know, not a sort of small economy in terms of the U.S. You've got 600 major U.S. corporations actually invested in South Africa, and so there's a lot invested in the country, and that ranges from the Microsofts and Apples to Levi's and Goldman Sachs and so on. So across a range of industries, the U.S. has a base in South Africa. Just secondly, to focus a little bit about the U.S., South Africa and aid flows, PEPFAR is the largest, so that's the sort of HIV/AIDS program. That's its largest base is in South Africa, and it's done phenomenally well in terms of complementing the ARV treatment program. I want to take a slightly different tack. I think despite the great successes of PEPFAR, there's been a lack of a focus on some of the economic challenges facing South Africa. So you think of micro-enterprises, an economy with 25% unemployment rates, 40% for young people, 45% for women. That gets relatively little attention through the U.S. donor channels that they used to. So in the early 94, 95 years, you used to see a lot of economic linkages type support. That's sort of been trumped pretty much by PEPFAR. And I think, and if you listen to Whitney and Mwangi, I think the time is right for actually that switch back to economic linkages, economic type support, reducing poverty, inequality, and so on. And one can talk more a bit about that. Thirdly, in terms of the U.S. and trade flows and FDI, there's been a new signal when Hillary Clinton visited South Africa, they signed the Trade and Investment Framework Agreement. The counterpart signed that, and that was an agreement between business leaders in the U.S. to talk to government in South Africa around problems, constraints on investing in South Africa. So I think that's, again, a step forward in the right direction. We worry a little bit about fund managers in South Africa polluting our capital flows and influencing our currency, but that's our issue, so we've got to figure that out. But that's a huge sort of currency issue for South Africa. South Africa remains keen to continue with AGOA, and you know, that's come out in public statements. But I do think that it's still pretty much, again, leaning on what Mwangi said, it's pretty much an old-style route into South Africa. Let's go back to our old networks. Let's keep the current companies going. There hasn't really been a presence of U.S. companies since 94 taking advantage of the new opportunities in South Africa. And there are many new ones that have been taken up by China, by India, and to some extent even by Russia. So you're seeing new emerging markets entering into other emerging markets like South Africa and taking advantage of economic opportunities in a way where the U.S. already with a foothold arguably hasn't done enough. I use one example. I'm probably going to get wrapped over the knuckles for this, but I'm an academic, so it doesn't matter. Apple Computers has a presence, an okay presence in South Africa, but a very, very poor after-sales service, right, and a very poor supply of their own products in South Africa, and it's a huge market, but nothing's happened. You have to send, you know, products to North Africa to get it fixed and things like that. So there's one example of how, the U.S.'s most valuable company hasn't sort of quite caught on to the opportunities available in South Africa. Then fourthly, and I'll try and be brief, South Africa needs to be seen by the U.S. as a portal into Africa. China's seen that very clearly. China bought 20% of Standard Bank of South Africa as the sort of financial highway into Africa. The U.S. hasn't done that yet, right? And I think the extent to which the U.S. strategy needs to figure out that South Africa, with its presence in telecoms, in finance, in retail, can be that bridge into an infrastructure, can be that bridge into the continent. And not just as the continent's largest economy with Nigeria, but certainly as a dominant presence in Africa already, the U.S. needs to find a strategy to link into South Africa in that manner. I think the Walmart deal is an example of trying to do that in a very innovative way. It's not clear that other corporates have followed. And I think it's partly to do, and one can generate in discussion, partly to do with the mindset of U.S. corporates, not as risk-taking as emerging market corporates, and I think that's partly what's going on. The fifth point is whether the U.S. can think more creatively about South Africa in the context of South Africa as an emerging market on the global stage. So South Africa's involvement, keeping in mind this historical link, right, that's fairly positive. So you've got South Africa at BRICS, South Africa as a member of the G20, South Africa as a member of the UN, a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. So there are all sorts of global stages that South Africa operates in, and it's not clear to me that the U.S. has quite figured out how to deal with South Africa in that context. And I think it's critical. And if one thinks of the BRICS Bank, for example, as one thing. So then just finally, a few comments about the U.S. in Africa. I mean, there's a huge demographic dividend that's been predicted and projected for Africa, right? So between 2015 and 2030, about 470 million people will enter the labor force globally. The majority of those individuals will come from South Asia and Africa. So in the context of where Africa is going, there's a huge demographic dividend waiting to be exploited, if you like. If one thinks of Unilever's presence in Africa, Unilever's figured this out, right, and they're projecting ahead. That being said, you've got 6 of the 10 fastest-growing economies in the world in Africa, admittedly of a very low base. You've got dynamic opportunities that are being exploited, by China and India and other economies. So to some extent, the U.S. has a foothold already, but recognizing that these are new and dynamic opportunities both now and the future is critical. The final point, and it's almost a suggestion, is that I think there does need to be a differentiated strategy when the U.S. deals with Africa. And I've given just one example of how you can think of the continent in a different way. There are one take of types of economies you have in Africa are those that are growth nodes. So in other words, Those are almost middle-income countries or large, stable economies, South Africa, Nigeria, Mauritius, Kenya maybe, Rwanda. They are growth nodes. The kind of interaction the U.S. needs with them is very different. You then have fast-growing, low-income countries, Mozambique, Zambia, Uganda, right? Most of your Africa success stories are low-income countries. There, the interaction is slightly different, right? It's and then you have the fragile states issue, right? So your Somalias and Zimbabwe, and their governance, security, post-conflict type U.S. foreign policy issues come into play. But I think in the first two, you need a far more nuanced and sort of mixed model of interaction.
Okay, let me stop there. So we're going to now go to questions. We'll make sure to also take questions from the line as well. Anybody here in the room want to start off?
Yeah. Can I ask about sort of the notion of a competition between China and the U.S. in particular for Africa, for its natural resources, for its allegiance, what have you? To what extent is that real, and to what extent has it been overstated, do you think?
Okay, so
Mwangi, you might identify yourself.
This is Mwangi Kemenyi of Brookings. What we have seen recently, initially, if you look at you go back 20, 25 years back, and look at who was actually in Africa, in the natural resource sector. Go to Nigeria, for example, the Nile Delta. What you see there are the American companies. You see Chevron, you see Shell. They are the ones who have control of most of the blocks there and have been there for some time. You go to Congo, DRC, you find American companies and so on. Now, if you look at the last 20 years or so, first of all, there have been a lot of new discoveries of natural resources, oil and gas in many of these countries. But if you look at who is really there, you find that China is probably there, maybe 80%. Is the country that is controlling those natural resources. So it's not I would not say that there is competition. It's a total dominance by the Chinese in the natural resource sector in Africa. New ones, but the old ones is still the United States, Britain, French, and so on.
Let me just respond. This is Whitney Schneidman. Number one, I think it's important that we don't look at the U.S.-China competition for natural resources in Africa as a zero-sum proposition. And the reason for that is that, as Mangi said, U.S. companies, largely in oil, gas, but also in mining, have been in Africa for a very long time, and they have a very established presence. China is a new entrant. They've been very quick to move. They've been very aggressive. They have a lot of resources to invest. But in some areas, Chinese companies and American companies are actually working together in certain blocks and with British companies as well. So I don't think that's as much of an issue as is what is the nature of China's engagement in Africa? What is the nature of the contract? Is China training workers? Are they investing in communities? Are the deals transparent? I think those are the issues that really deserve more conversation.
This is Harun Borat. I mean, an example of why one that is a bit too simplistic to think of it as a U.S. versus China is that the deal that the Bank of China did with Standard Bank in South Africa was intermediated by Goldman Sachs. And so in many senses, where there are opportunities, large corporates will not sort of, assume because you're Chinese or U.S.-based, the deal won't go ahead. I think the real key question is whether, for the long-run growth of the continent, you're going to see practices by foreign investors which protect the integrity of the growth pattern, so ensure that there's minimal corruption, rent-seeking, institutions are protected, and, in a way, the resource acquisition by both China, the U.S., and the EU can actually build some sort of secondary industry and in that way protect the, if you like, the growth path of the continent. I think that's the...
What's the early evidence on that score?
I think the evidence...
Well, I mean, again, just to follow up on that, I don't think there has been, this is Mwangi again, I don't think there are major differences in terms of moving from natural resources to transforming African economies, whether it's by EU or by Americans. I mean, American companies operating in Niger Delta just take away the oil. We don't see other secondary industries coming up. And in terms of some of the practices, they are equally bad. I mean, Niger Delta is one of the most polluted areas in the continent by the American companies. So we may trust China, but I think we need to be careful because the practices by American companies are equally bad. But in terms of what Africa really needs, it's moving these natural resources from just taking them away to really having transforming economies, building fertilizer factories, for example, power generation to fuel the economies. That's what's happening that's what's not happening in Africa in the area of natural resource exploitation by Americans, by EU, by China. And that's a big problem for Africa, I think.
I mean, part of American companies in the extractive sectors have a long tradition of corporate social responsibility. And whether it's investing in the health sector or malaria, making antiretrovirals available, education, training, there's a long tradition of doing that. For instance, if you go to Chevron's offices in Angola, 80% of those people working there are going to be Angolans. You can't say that for a lot of other companies, certainly Chinese. But the point's well taken. What we haven't seen is a lot of ancillary businesses grow out of the extractive sectors. So it is a bit of an enclave initiative, and I think that's really the challenge. How can European oil companies, American, Chinese, really stimulate broad-gauge growth in these economies?
Rune, did you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to come in and say partly it's also the responsibility of national governments, right? I mean, so the utilization of revenue generated from FDI, whether it's tax revenue or other forms, must be invested responsibly, right? And to some extent, a secondary industrialization program does feed off the effect of utilization of resource revenues, and you haven't quite seen that in the African context. So it's partly, it's not just blame the investor, but it's also blame local governments. And I think if a link can be made between that and how aid flows facilitate better institutions, better governance, better fiscal responsibility, and so on, I think you can begin to see that secondary effects.
George,
George Condon with National Journal. Can you elaborate a little bit on the president's relationship with the continent? There was so much excitement, if not jubilation, when he was elected. Do they now see him as just another American president? I assume there's still some excitement. Do they understand that he had an economic crisis to deal with at first that might have diminished the impact? I mean, what is the relationship?
Okay, so I think when the president came to power, there was too much excitement, and it was misplaced. It was within the president was facing problems in Iraq, Afghanistan, so and of course the economic crisis at home. So he didn't have all those resources to deal with. So there was an excitement, but a bit misplaced. The expectations were too high. However, Africans still consider Clinton their president. I mean, if you go to Africa and mention Clinton, I mean, he is a hero even today. I don't think Obama, President Obama, is going to approach the level of President Clinton at all in terms of respect, in terms of what they see, and partly because as one whose father is from Africa, the expectations were rather high. I mean, they expected him to do more, to do more visits, to actually link better with Africans, to understand the continent better. So what I see when I go to Africa is people are very cynical. They are not excited. Of course, there will be excitement where he goes, but there is not that feeling that, we have our son there. There is probably more reference of a prodigal son than a son.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate, I think if you asked the average South African, which president in the post 94 environment has been most, which US president has been most sort of prominent in a South Africa US dialogue, and it would be President Clinton, hands down. And we all know globally the sort of President Clinton, President Mandela relationship was very strong. And if anything, President Obama, you know, is seen on equal par with any other sort of leading developed country president. Doesn't have a particular affinity or link to South Africa.
Yeah, I think the first term President Obama was quite constrained by the two wars and the economy. But there's another factor that people sort of tend to overlook, and that was, you know, the whole birther movement here in the U.S. that was sort of questioning his place of birth to begin with, and that it made it, I think, it was a real constraint on dealing with Africa. It's true President Clinton is held in a lot of affection. A lot of that is just the nature of who President Clinton is anyway. But I think that there is a concern. When I travel in Africa, I frequently hear, you know, where are the Americans? You know, China's there, Brazil's there, everybody's there. And hopefully this trip begins to sort of reverse that. And that the kind of excitement is generated, but more importantly, the kind of programs and initiatives are generated that really provide the underpinning for a deeper engagement.
I mean, you said, I was struck by the fact that you had a much more optimistic first take, I think, than Mwangi's had. Why do you feel that way, despite the record that this administration has shown, or lack thereof? And you talked about the sort of plan that the administration laid out last year. Some people mentioned it came in June or something in the campaign, and seemed to just be kind of thrown out as an afterthought almost. And you seem much more optimistic. I'm wondering why, and why, if they were so eager to do this now, why they weren't. You mentioned some of the constraints right there, but why they.
This is Whitney Schneidman. Because I think President Obama really cares about Africa. We've never had a president that has been there as many times before becoming president as he has. Obviously, we've never had a president whose family comes from Africa. So he knows about the continent. He's aware of developments. But I think it's been very difficult for him to impact on U.S. policy for the various reasons that I've mentioned and others. So I see that PPD, the Presidential Policy Directive, even though you read it, it's a very bland document. But from the being inside government point of view, a lot of work went into that. And it focuses the attention of agencies, and a lot of the initiatives that we're going to see rolled out on this trip are a result of that process. So you don't necessarily see, it doesn't make the news every day, if at all. But a lot of work is going on to how can, you know, what's the Obama legacy going to be in Africa? And so I think it's too early to tell, but there's clearly a concern about it.
One follow-up, too. You compared him to President Clinton. How would you compare President Obama, it doesn't have to be the whole continent, but certain countries in South Africa and others, to President Bush? And what's President Bush's legacy?
Mwangi, do you want to?
And I'm talking about President George W.
Yeah.
Yes. Very positive. Actually, it's surprising, and it actually surprised Africans who don't expect much from Republican presidents. And if you look at the aid program, the major aid program that my colleague was talking about, you think about MMC, the major infrastructure program. These are creative things. These are creative programs that came under President Bush. We don't see that type of thing. In fact, I would like to disagree a little bit with my colleague about the strategy that was launched in June, which talked about the new strategy. And if you look at it, there's really nothing new, and there's nothing strategic, which is actually amazing. If you think about it, the same governance pillars and so on, it's really not a strategic document. And I think what will really work for Africa is programs, cooperative programs like MMC. But the other thing, which again I agree with Whitney here, is that what Africa needs is not just money going to aid programs. It is collaborative business ventures that add value, that create jobs. That's what Africa is looking for. It's really more on the investment side, not just money.
Do you want to?
Do Africans expect that he would have visited Kenya? Do they understand the reason for not visiting Kenya? Is that controversial at all?
I'm from Kenya. That question should probably go to someone else. But yes, there is a disappointment that has actually turned out to be a joke now. Because it would have expected, people have been talking about what President Kennedy did. One of the questions he visited was actually to Ireland. There were criticisms, by the way, that the family was associated with IRA a long time ago. If you read the history, you see. But he went there, and he met his family. He met his uncles. President Clinton went to see where he comes from. President Reagan went to where he comes from. So this was there was a real expectation that President Obama would go, probably go to his father's grave, lay a wreath there, he's still his father. So there's quite a bit of disappointment. However, the talk in Kenya, which I just came from, was that because there was a clearly negative, there was real opposition against the current leadership, and there was the talk about consequences for electing President Uhuru and Ruto. This is one of the consequences. So one of the things they are saying is that, do you want Air Force One or do you want free to choose? Which is a bit rather bad thing for people to be saying about the president.
This is Whitney Schneider. And personally, I would love to see President Obama go to Kenya. I would, even on this trip, to sort of break away and do a personal trip to go see his grandmother in Nakuru, very powerful symbol of the depth of the U.S. relationship with Africa. And I hope it happens before the end of this administration, because I think it's important in many dimensions.
I mean, they're saying we can't go when the new president is an indicted war criminal. If that were said in Africa, would people be understanding of it, or would they say, what are you, crazy?
I think there are ways of doing it. You know, when President Clinton went to Africa in 1998, he took a couple of days and went to Botswana on a personal trip in the game park and just had a day or two of downtime. So I don't see why he can't fly to Nakuru, have some downtime with his grandmother, yeah, and just enjoy it and leave those issues to another day.
Can I just take quick questions from the call? Anyone on the line want to ask a question?
Yeah, this is Kathleen Hennessy from the LA Times. I wanted to ask a little bit about Mandela. I know that his condition seems to be improving, and I don't know that we're going to get a meeting between the two, but if anyone has any insight into the relationship there between the president and Mandela, and even just sort of in the public imagination, how those two leaders may or may not be linked, I'd be interested in hearing that.
I mean, I think, this is Harun Borat, I think it's partly, I mean, the relationship is shaped by what has been said earlier, right? So you've had a President Obama who hasn't visited the continent, hasn't visited South Africa, and I think it's important to emphasize that they're sort of determinant factors, right? Sort of the birth movement and two wars and so on that have kept President Obama away. But on the other side, you've got President Mandela who's been very, very ill, and in that context, not that he can't accept visitors, but that it's very difficult for him to remain engaged in the public life, even if it's commenting on, say, President Obama's not visiting South Africa or engaging more with the president's wife when she visited South Africa. I think, effectively we have in President Mandela somebody who is, you know, so ill that it's very, very difficult for him to productively engage in public life, and I think that's acted as a constraint. My sense is, were this 10 years earlier, President Mandela would have reached out. Being President Mandela, he would have reached out to President Obama, and I think the relationship would have been a very sort of warm and productive one. I have no doubts about that.
I'd like to say that I think that what would be significant, I think it's symbolic but important, is the visit to Robben Island, where Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years. I think that is a fairly emotional trip, and they should give him probably some closeness. Most of us who have visited that place. And I was hoping that he would also visit the Gori Island in Senegal, which would have also given him a real perspective which was the main slave trading center in Senegal. I think that would have been...
He is going to Goriaira.
Then that would be quite a real connection about the history. And I think those places will probably make him get a better connection to Africa.
Yeah, this is Whitney Schneidman. President Obama does have a relationship with President Mandela. Obama visited Mandela in 2007 when he was in South Africa. Michelle Obama visited President Mandela when she was there summer before last. And most recently, President Mandela sent President Obama a signed copy of his most recent book. So I think there is a recognition of just the importance that these two individuals are to each other.
Margaret Collins, I wanted to ask you about the Obama-Mandela relationship also, but if I can just sort of take it to a different level. What do you see as kind of the continuum of the Mandela legacy and the Obama legacy? I mean, you're right that because of a variety of things, including Mandela's declining health, I haven't had much of a chance to engage that much personally, but it's the first black president in the States, the first black president of South Africa, the end of the sunset of one's life, the sort of apex of another's life. What do you see as the similarities between the two? What do you see as the differences between the two? Is there any sort of Mandela legacy that you think Obama should be carrying on globally or in the U.S.?
So, yeah, right. How long do we have?
So there is only one President Mandela, I have to say that, as a South African. And I think, anybody sort of trying to take on from there at a global level is always going to come out second best. I think, if President Obama can use the goodwill that he has no doubt accumulated in the first two terms globally to actually, for example, one of the things is to try and look at the something that I'm working on at the moment, the post-2015, the post-Millennium Development Goals environment within the United Nations. Somebody as sort of powerful as President Obama can actually be a rallying person for thinking about the Millennium Development Goals post-2015 for Africa, engaging in social causes that actually not only promote Africa in terms of HIV/AIDS programs and sort of educational programs, in terms of trade and investment. So his legacy could be concentrated around the continent, and I think that would tie him, President Obama, to President Mandela's legacy. But at the same time, they're very different personalities operating in very different environments with different constraints. President Mandela spent 26 years in prison and forged a struggle against minority rule, but then brought peace to a country that was on the verge of bloodshed. I think that's a very different environment to that of President Obama. Yet, there's of course a rebirth quite important in the context of President Obama as the first black president of the U.S. And that's perhaps the bridge that can be built. But in order to draw a comparison post-President Obama's second term to President Mandela, he would almost need to build some sort of global legacy around global issues, be it poverty, inequality, malnutrition, and I think that's the real challenge for President Obama. I mean, President Mandela's legacy globally has been around peace building. Mm-hmm. It's been around building bridges amongst people who are in conflict. So there are various entry points for President Obama. It's just not clear at this stage which one he would use to build his legacy.
Do we have more questions from the line?
This is Kathleen again. I'd take one more, if I could, on more specifically on the president's AIDS and HIV programs. Obviously, you mentioned that this would be a key part of Bush's legacy. Is there a sense that the president has just funded the PEPFAR program and done nothing more, or could you give some sort of more specific assessment of just that area?
Yes, this is Whitney Schneidman. I think the president, this administration has funded PEPFAR. I think it continues to be an essential program, and it's made a transformative difference in Africa. But there's no question that this is a Bush legacy. And I think what President Obama is trying to do, is, as I mentioned earlier, sort of pivot from the relationship of the past. Really, U.S. policy toward Africa has been predicated on a donor-recipient relationship. And I think he's trying to move it to one of more mutual benefit. So clearly, programs such as PEPFAR, which are so critical, will, I think, continue to exist and be funded. But, you know, it's really what's next and where do we need to get to and how are we going to get there? And I think that's what President Obama is trying to do. And that's why we're going to see more of a focus on the business side, on the trade side, on the investment side, underpinned by rule of law, by good governance, by democracy.
Any more questions from anyone on the line or anyone in the room?
Could you address some of the security issues? There's always been an effort to focus on economics and development, yet unrest in, you know, in Mali and the Sahel, in Congo, always exists as a sort of an elephant in the room, if you will. How will those issues be dealt with on this trip and not overshadow the important issues? And the second question is, you talked about the disappointment of not going to Kenya. Why is the president not, for example, going to Nigeria, which is, after all, more like South Africa in terms of its magnitude and as a player? Mm-hmm. And the last thing is, if you could talk a little bit about what the president wants from, you mentioned South Africa's role in sort of global fora, the G20 and the BRICS. What does the president want out of South Africa and the United Nations Security Council? What does the president want out of that diplomacy and a legion in terms of support in international fora?
Okay, so let me, this is Mwangi again. Let me take a quick stab at this. First of all, actually, I just wrote a piece on that. I said one of the significance of this trip is more the countries he is not visiting than the ones he is visiting. Not to take away from South Africa. But Nigeria is one of those countries, I say, that it seems to me a real oversight not to visit Nigeria. I mean, Nigeria is a major driver in the West African region. It's been so involved in the peacekeeping efforts within that area. It has its problems with Boko Haram, which should be worrying the United States. But that's the tough areas that the president needs to go and deal with those type of issues. So in my view, ignoring Nigeria, which is really the driver, and then if you go to Nigeria as a president, you are not seen as visiting Nigeria per se. You are seen to have visited the region. If you go to Senegal, you went to Senegal. You didn't go to West Africa. So
I would have hoped that
whoever helped plan the trip for the president in a strategic way would have included Nigeria. It's a very important country, and it's likely going to overtake some other economies
in Africa.
That's what we hear. So in that sense, I think that's an issue. But security, the engagement of U.S. for the longest of time, there's of course that business component, but security is always a concern, and it's a priority always. So part of the engagement issue that, I mean, the focus by the president will always be on security, which, again, is surprising that he missed particularly Kenya, because Kenya, again, has been a partner with the United States in terms of the Al-Shabaab. Okay, so this is the country that has done a lot of work with dealing with Al-Shabaab and also with the North Sudan, South Sudan peace. So it's, again, an issue there. So in that sense, I am sure that he will stress issues of security throughout his trip. I don't have much more about skipping Kenya, so I'll ask.
Let me just respond to the
one of both mistakes before
being. I just want to respond to the security dimension that you raised, because I think it's really critical. And my concern is that there's an imbalance in U.S. policy. It's almost too much security, not enough trade and development. trade and investment. And I say that because the Pentagon has a presence in 5 African countries. The U.S. Commerce Department has a presence in 3 African countries. And I think it should be just the reverse. So security is very important, but I think it's equally as important to get the balance right so that we understand that U.S. policy is not just sort of drones in Somalia or drones in Mali if that happens, but it's a much broader engagement.
So we know Nigeria is catching up, which is fine, good for the continent. But I mean, in the just on the conflict issue, South Africa has established something called SADPA, the South African Development Partnership Agency, and that's a crucial change, right? In how South Africa, and it's basically a fund to support African development. A lot of it is around security, actually. And if you think of the Central African Republic issue and so on. So to some extent, you know, that's the point that a more, perhaps not only a reorientating away from security towards commerce, but also looking for partnerships is one of the things that the U.S. needs to look to, partnerships within Africa in terms of security issues, and seeing some economies as sort of partners in conflict prevention, certainly when there are border disputes and things like that. It's a good question. What does the U.S. get out of sort of South Africa's role in these global fora? I mean, for one, at least not shutting the door on them. I mean, you get a sense almost in the sort of geopolitical discussions that the BRICS is considered only BRICS, and you know the U.S. will stay out of it and so on. And I think that's probably not the right strategy. If you take the BRICS bank, I think it'll be crucial for the U.S. to engage with South Africa as a partner and say, well, look, are there ways in which we can provide technical assistance, financial assistance, you know, sort of can Goldman Sachs be involved because they have an office and, the lead in the office is a very influential person. The former governor of our central bank works for Goldman Sachs, for the office in South Africa. So, you know, there are ways in which the U.S. could position itself relative to the opportunities that may arise out of these global fora. That I don't think is happening at the moment. And I think the closer attention the U.S. pays to the Nigerias and the South Africans involved in these global fora, and figuring out what deals are being struck there or what opportunities may lie, I think you're likely to see opportunities for the U.S.
Could I ask one just kind of technical follow-up to something that was said much earlier, which is, Mwangi, you mentioned that President Obama will have now visited 4 compared to the Chinese 30 countries. Are we talking strictly about sub-Saharan Africa? Because President Obama has visited Egypt. I just want to make sure that if we quote those numbers, the numbers are, you know,
yeah,
apples to apples.
So I'm talking more about sub-Saharan Africa. The reason for, let me say why I'm not counting Egypt. That mission was not to communicate, lead it to the African people per se. It was supposed to communicate to the Muslim of the people of the world. So it was not a bit. It was, but yeah, Egypt is in the continent. But so I'm talking about the visit by Chinese leaders when the vice president and the president over the last 5 years have been really intense. That's what I think.
So, yeah. And so would the 30 number for Chinese leaders include North African countries?
I think two or so Northern African countries.
Okay. So if we're going to be hydro Egypt, just to be kind. I mean,
we can say 5 and 30 then.
5 and 30.
Could I ask you to go back? Sorry. I talk about the economy a little bit. You mentioned somebody mentioned six of the 10 fastest growing the world in Africa, although from a low base. Obviously, countries, continents can have false dawns. Africa's gotten a lot of attention, including from the IMF and World Bank. But how is there, you know, a real sense that this is, that something has fundamentally changed about the growth outlook, or are there worries about its sustainability? And then second, other than the power sector, what are the areas of greatest opportunity?
Okay. So I think you're right. I mean, it's not all good news, right? I mean, so the six of the ten, sorry, are the fastest growing, but a very, very low base. But the other thing is, many of them have been riding a sort of a natural resource price highs, right? So you've got this sort of price boom in natural resources, and so the Zambian Zambian sort of being upgraded to middle-income country status is basically because of the copper price. It still, in many senses, has the attributes of being a low-income country, and I think that's a very important point, that one shouldn't lose, one shouldn't go to the other extreme and say, this is the next, the next East Asia. Yet, that being said, I think that, you know, there are a couple of factors that do suggest that this time may be different. One is the demographic dividend that I mentioned. The fact that you've got these, you know, large numbers of sort of individuals streaming onto the labor market at least provides an opportunity for sustaining this growth path, right? The second is technology, right? So the technology in the development economics literature affords the opportunity to leap over stages of development. So you don't need landlines any longer, right? So cell phones, end technologies and so on have allowed development to be sustained in Africa. And the third, I think, is the institutions and governance issue, right? So I think for the first time you're beginning to see a fair degree of stability, the sort of one man, and it's always a man, one man run countries for decades, that sort of those despots and dictatorships, I think that era is over. So I think that constellation of factors suggests that we may have a chance this time, so that it may be a new dawn. But I think the core point is that don't sort of overstate the extent to which you're going to see 10-12% growth rates right into high-income country status. I'll just end off with one thing, is that if you look at a country like Mozambique, it's a fascinating example of the pitfalls as well as the opportunities. Mozambique has been riding against one of the six fastest-growing economies in the world, one of the ten. But that's been driven by resources, right? And so they're partly facing a Dutch disease problem, right? So they've been struggling to get the manufacturing base off the ground, but at the same time have been dynamic enough to create large numbers of urban informal sector jobs for young people. Going ahead, the growth of those people into the labor force is going to increase further. The challenge then is, can they create a sufficient number of manufacturing jobs and convert the sort of resource-based economic production system to a light manufacturing? And I think, so you've got an opportunity, but the question is, can Africa convert it? And I think that's, so the jury's still out in terms of the long run.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think it's true, the institutions have improved. We have better, I mean, from where we were, Africa was starting, we have better institutions in terms of governance, but we have more democratic institutions. The other one, which is quite significant, is the macroeconomic management. Sure. Look at the inflation rates for this country, for example. You see fairly stable policy making. There has been a real change from 70s, 80s, and 90s, where you had inflation rates of 100. Of course, we still have Zimbabwe getting there now and then. But the other one is the climate for doing business. There's been major improvements in the environment for doing business. If you look at the doing business indicators, Africa is the country recording the best improvement. It's still lower, but if you look at annual improvement in the environment for doing business, meaning lowering the cost of doing business, Africa is actually doing very well. So in that sense, we see this growth as better founded on fundamentals than just the natural resources.
Just to add, this is Whitney Schneidman. If you take a 20-year perspective, the number of democracies that have emerged in that period of time has gone from one hand to multiples of that. Economic management, the improvement, is quite important. That the efforts by the international community to reduce Africa's external debt has been quite important. But I think one of the dimensions, just to add to what my colleague said, has been the emergence of the African consumer. If you look at a lot of the McKinsey reports, they make the point that for every $1 of economic growth that comes from natural resources, $5 comes from consumer activity, services of various kinds. And I think, you know, we've seen the emergence of a middle class, some 350 million people that have disposable income, that they've got mortgages, they're cars, they're investing in tuitions, and that's really helping to change the landscape and, I think, fuel this growth.
Did you have one more question?
Yeah, I'll be really brief, and if we can pull aside if you want to instead. President Obama always gives a major speech whenever he makes a visit to a country or to a continent, or in this case, sort of both. So Bobby Kennedy, of course, has a liberal approach speech. What do you see as Obama sometimes doesn't miss an opportunity to speak? So my question is,
or Lincoln.
What does he want to do and need to do in that speech? I don't know how much it matters for journalists. We all look at the speech. I don't know how much people are listening. But if he wants to really knock it out of the park, what is that speech supposed to be about?
If I were to say one word, well, I've been away, but America is still in the game. So we are still involved in this continent. We care. And Africa wants to be engaged with Africa. America wants to be engaged with Africa. I think that will be the broad message that you try to spearhead. I don't know.
And I would just add, I mean, one concept that would knock it out, I think for most Americans would be different, a clear statement that Africa's a continent of vast opportunity and that the U.S. needs to be part of that for our own self-interest as well as to make sure that opportunities fully realized.
For me, the two key things. One is to recognize what the data is showing, that this is the final frontier, so to speak, and the U.S. is right there with Africans and willing to work with them productively, not just as a donor. I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is to recognize, and we keep on coming back to this, the heterogeneity in Africa. You know, all African economies are not the same, right? Mm-hmm. Tanzania is very different to a Mauritius, to a Madagascar, mm-hmm. and to a Nigeria. And I think that recognition would almost get the kind of response from Africans that we're not seen as a homogenous continent.
Thank you, everybody. I just want to let you know we're going to have a transcript and an audio recording, so we'll send it out. It'll probably be available tomorrow morning. Maybe this afternoon, but we'll send it out to everybody as soon as you get it. You can also email me, and I'll make sure to send it to you all. Thank you very much for joining.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you very much, all of you.